Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunk. This past week we did an interview with Nefario, and we were cut short as we were just getting into some interesting areas concerning the U.S. senators and the new publicity crashing down heading at the Bitcoin about the Silk Road and Tor and everything, and we didn't get too much into it. So welcome back to the show, Nefario.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, you want to give us an update? It's been a week since the last show when this all the publicity hit. And can you tell us what some update on this whole thing with the Silk Road? And we'll just fly into these topics.
So from what I know, when this whole thing hit the papers and then the senators started coming out against this, Silk Road was shut down at that time. And the idea, a lot of people thought that it was because of the publicity that they were trying to lay low and maybe make sure that their system wasn't found out, like the location of the system, just in case there was some vulnerability in Tor. Turns out that actually what had happened was because of the publicity, the traffic to the site was getting to a level that they couldn't handle it. So they shut down their system and upgraded, and then they were back online a few days later.
Oh, okay.
So all this publicity, this is I don't know how much publicity they have, but it must have been at least $2 or $3 million worth of advertising, essentially, for the Silk Road. Every person who's ever taken an illegal substance is after hearing this and going, interesting, and trying to visit the site.
Yeah, right. And then looking how to get a hold of the Bitcoins.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Reading up on what's this Bitcoin thing. It's interesting as well. I read the original request from Schumer, and it doesn't name Bitcoin specifically. It just says an anonymous currency, anonymous digital currency that's used for money laundering.
He wasn't referring to U.S. dollar cash.
No, he wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Although it's interesting though, you know, although like Bitcoin wasn't named specifically in the request, everybody knows that he's speaking about Bitcoin and that Schumer and other senators are going to, at some point in the future, start coming down on Bitcoin, trying to, I don't know what they're going to try and regulate it first and try and get it banned, but if, I'd say their efforts are going to come to very little if, you know, if their understanding of the system isn't up to scratch, because they wanted to seize the onion domain from the Silk Road. That was actually in the request to the Department of the DEA.
Right.
And they want to seize the .onion domain. You know, they said, go seize this domain, bring it down. And obviously then, and I think it's interesting, they must know, or they must have advisors that know that that can't work, because they had people who were able to get Tor working and then get onto the website to find out, you know, what it is and have a look at it to be able to bring it down, or not bring it down, but to be able to see what it is and then, you know, write this request and still make such a glaring mistake. So I think that they don't understand the technology. They don't really understand what they're dealing with.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's maybe they just downloaded one of those standalone Firefox with Tor bundled in it, and they went to the Onion address, but just not really thinking or not understanding that it's an internal Onion domain. Yeah, what's interesting too for some of the listeners out there is that the Onion top level domain, you know, you have this long number, it's a hash of a it's a long number. You have all these letters and numbers in it, and it says .onion. So a lot of people think that it's just this domain. The domain names inside of Tor are these huge random numbers for some reason, but actually what it is, it's the something like the hash of the
of a public key,
right? So it's the hash of a public key that is used for the encryption that your data is being encrypted to the destination website, so
such that only the website can unencrypt it.
Yeah, so it's a nice little way so if you have a public key, if you had a PGP public key, and let's say your email address was in some type of, let's say you had a communications network out there that was a PGP communications network, basically your address inside of the system for sending messages to you would be your PGP fingerprint .pgp. So it would be, that would be your destination address. So these guys are essentially saying, you know, seize their fingerprint. it's not a location as much as it is an identifier, and then the network in this case uses that identifier and the key as a way of doing its routing and the like. So it is quite humorous.
And it would be nice actually if someone in the Tor community were to implement the kind of address book thing that I2P has. I think it's doable, but I don't know if they're going to bother getting around to it.
Yeah, how would you see that you mean for alternate address?
Instead of having the long kind of 32 or 64-bit character name, then .onion, the way the address book system works is you put in like a .onion address as your kind of DNS server. You actually use DNS, but you know, you put it into the system, and it goes there and looks up. It'd still be like a Tor address,
yeah.
A .onion address, but it'd be like, you know, the Silk Road .onion, and then it would go to the address,
right,
server and check,
yeah,
what's under the Silk Road, and then pull the full address out.
Yeah,
kind of how I2P works.
Yeah,
can work.
That wouldn't be too hard to do. I mean, you could do it into the. It would be nice if they had a mechanism in it, like you said, for the I2P actually has these your local address book that is local to you, and then it has various versions of addresses that are shared, where you can throw in an address book that you subscribe to, and then that updates in your local system. Yeah, that would be something they would need to throw into their distribution. But even at a local level, it wouldn't be that difficult. I mean, something like this could be done with a proxy server like Squid or Privoxy, where you have internal mappings so that a host name lookup then translates to the actual onion.
To the full address.
Yeah. It proxies through to that address, right? Uh-huh. So actually, there's several people working on some stuff like this right now. With the Open Transactions project, because Fellow Traveler has this protocol called the OTTP protocol, and he's working with this top-level domain called the OTC, Open Transactions Contract. And it's a method so that you can publish all of your fingerprints and IP addresses, like DNSSEC if you wish, and HTTPS, SSL TLS certificate fingerprints, and Tor addresses, I2P addresses, and whatnot for contact information or for where your website is located. And it signs it inside of the open transaction. It creates essentially a contract, and then that contract is distributed, and it can be used inside of your local DNS system for finding service locations and verifications of keys and the like. So this is
Fellow Traveler's attempt to solve the whole DNS domain name problem using open transactions?
I wouldn't say that he's trying to solve what everyone is trying to do. He's just coming up with a system that can solve a lot of the problems that people are trying to solve. I mean, because like one of the problems that I find the biggest problem that I have is not an alternate DNS system. What I want to know is I want to know the HTTPS fingerprint for all of the websites that I visit. I really don't care about the DNS names. You can give me a list of 20 DNS names. I want to know that I'm not getting the man in the middle. And the only way to know that is by checking the fingerprint. And nobody is distributing their fingerprints. Well, it's some of them are, but you got to ask.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So in this system, the idea is to try to make it simple so you could run the money changer client and you can, throw in some details of the domain names that you run and your fingerprints and then throw them out there and then they get distributed. And then you have a local DNS server or a DNS proxy that does its own. It will look at these contracts and pull out the proper keys and the locate and domain names and the like to always send you to the proper location. One example real quick, not to get too off here, but is if you do the let's say you went to glbsc.otc/tor, it would take you to the glbsc onion site. If you did /i2p, it would take you to the i2p site. So he's got some interesting things there with that.
That could turn out to be quite handy.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So back to the senators.
Yeah.
One of the things that really bugs them why they're going full out on this is because it's so open, it's so blatant, it's so out there in the open. That a website is running that lets people trade drugs. And in like the press release, they were saying that this website is flooding our streets with drugs. And I'd say probably they're doing a minimal amount of actual business before getting all this publicity. And but it's just the fact that it's out there in the open and it's so blatant. It's such a blatant finger up to the state that we have to crack down on this as an example.
Right.
Make an example of them that you can't thumb your nose at the state in this way. Certainly not with drugs anyway.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you can tell that with the way he made the topic on his stuff. What was it? This is the most bold, the boldest thing that they had ever seen by light years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Tor and Bitcoin, although Bitcoin itself, it can be used anonymously, or you can use it to make anonymous transactions. But that's not the default. So if you had who was it you had on here before who was talking about the Bitcoin mixer?
That was Mike Gogolsky.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you used his system or if you use another system, actually I think if you were to deposit Bitcoins into GLBSE and then leave them for a couple of days and then withdraw them, they'd be mixed up because we have a fair bit of activity going on and a lot of deposits and withdrawals now. So that would allow you to kind of mix up your Bitcoin. So you get some anonymity from this. But yeah, the fact that it's using Tor and combine that with Bitcoin, and the only thing that is missing is delivery service. So the only thing that that is no longer that's not anonymous in the whole system is the people who actually have to deliver or receive the goods. They have to give their address, and of course we're going to get a lot of kind of police stings over the next few weeks or months, possibly longer, that will they'll be posing as sellers, and they'll find people who are trying to buy and then get their address and then just go to their home and arrest them. So
you mean through like using exchangers, getting?
Not necessarily using exchangers. I'm talking about using Silk Road. So as far as I know, Silk Road is just kind of a market. Yeah. So you have something to sell, you put it up, and then someone wants to buy it. They buy it off. They buy it off you. They have to give you their address for you to send it to them. So I'd say that you're going to get a few feds and a few police who are going to be posing as sellers, and then as soon as someone goes to buy or attempts to buy, then they'll just send someone around to their home and arrest them.
Well, there's an interesting thing about this whole ecosystem using these technologies that is a really big monkey wrench for law enforcement. And, you sit back and look at how the system works, and you're going to see a lot of, like you said, people getting these police stings. But a lot of people, anybody out there right now, they're trying to buy from people who have been recommended this whole web of trust. So if you just get online and you just buy from anyone, that's like going out in the street and
hey, man, you got some weed? Can I buy something off you?
Right,
what?
Exactly.
No, okay. Hey, what about you?
Uh-huh. No. It usually doesn't happen like that. So what they do is they'll buy from someone that they know and that's recommended. So they'll be quiet, and there's going to be a lot of new people coming in and building up their reputation slowly, because anyone can get into. I'm sure that anyone can get into this right now if they have a few friends, because one, they build up and it just goes from friend to friend to friend, and then it expands out from there. But one of the things that this system does is that it's not meant so much to protect the buyer as it is meant to protect. Well, I shouldn't say meant. It's just the effects of the infrastructure.
It does.
Right. It protects the seller. Now, the seller with this type of protection, this is something that a lot of people don't realize, is that when the police right now, when they go after small guys, like in this case, you can sit here and say, well, the police are going to get on there and sell stuff, and then they're going to go bust the small guy. But when it comes down to it, a lot of times the police really don't care about the small guy. It's like in the gambling busts and stuff. They really don't care about all these people that are breaking the laws gambling. What they care about
because there's too many of them.
Well, they care about the big fish. They care about the gambling company. Who's the one? Where's all this money going? And they go and they, kidnap these guys and hold them ransom and let them go after they release their hundreds of millions and this stuff. And in this case, and a lot of, like, if you look at the DEA, okay, the DEA really doesn't care about your regular user, okay, unless they can get that user and then use him as an informant to work their way all the way up the chain. Now, that whole system that they have falls apart here because basically all of the sellers have plausible deniability. And I mean, you could say plausible deniability, but they have literal, complete deniability that they know who they bought this from. I mean, you bust anybody who's coming down and buying in this system, and then what do they say? They turn over their computer and they show that they, even if they gave over all their...
I bought from user ABC.
Yeah, they're...
I bought from username ABC, and they're like, damn, how do we find out who ABC is?
Exactly. So this is really crazy, because then all of a sudden what incentive do they have to go out and bust people from buying on Silk Road except just to like lock someone up and throw them away? They can't use them as an informant.
They could do they'll probably do a few kind of publicity arrests of end buyers, but apart from that, I don't think they won't be able to have any kind of effect on sellers.
Right.
And I'm sure just look at file sharing. Most people who share files, movies, music, and whatever, They do so in the knowledge that, yes, people, you know, quite a few people actually get taken to court and quite a few people get prosecuted and have to pay quite a bit of money. But the odds that it's going to be them are very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. You know, they know that it happens, but they know they assess the risk and that the generally they find that the risk is low. And so as a buyer, the risk is going to be relatively low. And as a seller, there's almost no risk because of the way, you know, Silk Road and Bitcoin allow this to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So well, the only thing missing for almost total anonymity is an anonymous delivery service where you can deliver to a person's ID as opposed to, or you can send a package to a person's ID as opposed to their home address. And this is something that BitDrop hopefully will be able to do.
Right. Yeah, I didn't think of that, sending to their identity where that could be like a drop point or whatever.
Well, you wouldn't even know like what the drop point is because it would go through several nodes before it would ever get to that drop point.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Okay. We covered this in the previous show. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh. Also, a quick update on the Nomacoin project, our kind of anonymous Bitcoin exchange project. That's on hold for the moment because we needed to get some people who were willing to be the vault, the central holders of cash, and we haven't been able to find anyone who's willing to do that. Or anyone trustworthy.
Yeah, you know, one thing I didn't understand about that is why do you need a holder, a vault? Why can't you just use people who are interested in being somewhat of like exchangers?
Well, the idea is to be able to have all the, we have like one kind of central exchange where all the, you know, if you deposit US dollars, then, you know, your account on central exchange will be credited with US dollars and then you can trade out with whoever. That needs to be in a kind of central location so we can keep account of it and kind of keep it safe.
There's exchangers that do this now for like, let's say Liberty Reserve and you send them, $200 and then they credit your account with 200. And it's not that they're holding some type of a pool. It's that they had already purchased 200 of Liberty Reserve, and therefore they have the ability to accept your 200 and then transfer over the Liberty Reserve to your account. So, I mean, it seems like you could almost have just if you weren't going to have a holding, then you would do an exchanger model where they have their accounts and they're accepting, you know, money in and out and moving it around. I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah. But for the moment, that's put off because I've got to put a lot of, we're making a couple of big pushes for the Global Bitcoin Stock Exchange for improving end user improvements and then also system improvements. I'm trying to roll out smart contracts at the moment. Well, trying to get smart contracts working, then roll them out. Then we'll be able to have a whole lot more stuff on the exchange. And then, you know, with user improvements, I think GLBSC, even with the new web interface, is still a bit difficult to use. So we're making improvements across the board. And we've also got a lot of development happening on BitDrop. So in about a week, well, it should be less than a week at this point, I should have something to play around with.
Okay.
And then we'll see where we go from there. So that's kind of taking up my time at the moment. So kind of have to put the Crypto Cloud and Nomacoin projects in the background for the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Super. It's good to hear that these things are moving along. How many developers do you have working on all of these projects?
So for BitDrop, I have two people on that. For GLBSE, I've got one person who's working on the client full-time at the moment. That's the web-based client. I've got one person working full-time on documentation because that's something we've been lacking and it's not something I have time to do myself. And then I've got one person who's working on doing an interface, a web-based interface, so companies can kind of have their information in one place. So you go to glbse.com/companies, and you can see all the companies that are listed on the exchange and information about them, and where to find more information and contact information and so on.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's good.
The thing with that is, so because we're using, like, everybody who's got an account on GeoBSE, they've got, like, a private key. So I'm going to try and use, like, a signing, kind of private key signs a token that will allow other websites to be able to use the resources for that user on GeoBSE. So it's kind of turning into an authentication system as well.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Great. That's something that we can talk about another time.
Yeah,
it's not fully fleshed out yet.
On that page, you'll be able to see their contract details and everything, too.
Yeah. And we've also just had some really badass charts for companies that are listed on the exchange at the moment. If you go to charts.glbse.com, you can see provided by bitcoincharts.org or .com, bitcoincharts.com, you can see, like, the full range of charts for everything that's listed on the exchange, and it looks really cool, and it makes viewing the information much easier.
Oh, cool! Great, that's nice. Hey, you want to give us some your thoughts on this this guy who left all these bitcoins sitting in his wallet of some ridiculous amount, and he got them ripped off or something?
Actually, there has been a lot of crime in the Bitcoin world in the last few days. That being the most the headline version. So this guy, basically, he was one of the early adopters, and he'd done a bit of mining at the beginning, and he just kind of held onto the coins and didn't do anything with them. And now those coins were worth close to $500,000. And he'd gone away and left his machine, come back a couple of hours later, and his Bitcoin was gone. Just gone. Either someone physically had come along and sent them to themselves, or someone had broken into his machine and done the same. And $500,000 of Bitcoin gone.
Yeah.
I would be climbing the walls if that happened to me. But at the same time, this is now, you know, everybody can now see that if you've got Bitcoin, you need to secure these, and you need to secure your desktop. You need to secure your machine, because this stuff it's valuable. You know, like, if you have 100, 200, or 1,000 Bitcoins, this stuff is valuable, and it's really easy to steal. And what happened just now is the digital equivalent of being pickpocketed. So the guy was walking around with a wallet with $500,000 worth of cash in it, and someone has pickpocketed him, pickpocketed from him his wallet, and the cash is now gone.
Okay, now to me, this sounds really sketchy to me, because one, does anyone know who this guy is? Is he well known? Does he have any type of reputation?
Not particularly. He's so that's another thing that's interesting. This whole because there's been a lot of claims by people saying that they've had their Bitcoin stolen from their machine for larger or smaller amounts. They've had their MTGOX website or MTGOX account hacked, and a few people have put up saying, yes, I've used a random password. Yes, it's not the same password I've used for any other site. So, like, all the boxes have been ticked for securely dealing with a website, and we know the MTGOX itself is under attack and has been continuously on and off for the last couple of weeks, whether via DDoS or some other means. They've covered the basic security, taken the basic security steps, you know, can't try a million passwords in a couple of seconds sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is this an attempt by a group of people to give the impression that if you deal with Bitcoin, that you're going to get robbed?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm not sure, because a lot of these users, you know, it's like, oh, I've had like $5,000 worth of Bitcoin, or $5,000 that I had in MTGOX have been stolen. A lot of these are fairly new people, and either they don't have you know, like they've on the forum, they've got, what is it, 5 posts, 20 posts, 12 posts. So they're not, so many of them are new. Some of them are fairly new. So I'm not sure how real this is. It could be a campaign by a group to discredit the safety of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Well, you know, but there's no telling how many people are going out there right now, and they're downloading the Bitcoin client, and they already have a botnet running in their machines. Okay? Because, you know,
yeah.
I mean, they're talking about regular Joes out there, and everyone already knows that all the botnets out there are on millions of machines or whatever the number is, of people that have no idea, you know, that their machines are actually being used for this stuff. And I saw a post yesterday some type of a virus has been discovered that's stealing a wallet, DAT files right now. So here's the thing with this guy, okay, is that Gawker, this website Gawker, they're the ones that put up the Bitcoin, the Silk Road, buy all the drugs thing a couple of weeks ago. And then they're the ones that pushed out this big thing in the news about this guy getting his 500 grand of Bitcoin stolen. So, you know, one, if this guy was an early miner and he had 500 grand, or how many was it, 25,000 coins or so? Was that what it was?
Some $500,000 worth of Bitcoins at the time.
Right. Okay. So, you're going to tell me if I was running this thing and I saw the prices of the Bitcoin shooting up and where they were worth nothing and now they're, you know, popping up to, let's say, like last week when they were up to the $30 a coin, you know.
Yeah, they're down to 20 at the moment.
I would, at the time that I saw these Bitcoins shooting up and I knew that I had, 1,000 coins, 2,000, 5, 10, 25,000 coins, I would have panicked to know that they were on my computer. It doesn't make sense to me that anybody who is involved with early mining would sit there full well knowing that these things are sitting on their machine. I mean, you know, without a backup.
You have to admit that people can often just be lazy. I know myself, I've got some Bitcoin on my machine, and, you know, I do have antivirus and the firewall and whatnot, but This event, whether it's true or not, is making me go over my system and change my passwords and whatnot. And I'm actually going to switch over to using Linux as my Bitcoin and development desktop as a result of this.
Well, yeah, and also have only consider your Bitcoin wallet just that, a wallet. It's not your Bitcoin safe.
Yeah.
Take whatever you cannot afford to lose or that you don't need for regular operating procedures, and have those in there, because like you said, the guy got pickpocketed with 500 grand, and it's like, who's walking around with 500 grand in their pocket? So I don't know. I guess it's easy to sit here and criticize this guy for complete stupidity, but I find it hard not to, because of the fact of the true value of these things. And anyone that knows anything about computer security knows that if you truly want a secure computer, you have to unplug it. You need to, like, pretty much snip the cable from the internet. It's like one of the oldest rules, you know? So, I don't know. I'm just kind of like, not really too sure that this guy, that it actually happened. Did he have a backup so that he had if he did have a backup, that doesn't mean he has a backup of the money, because once that's transferred, it's lost. But he would have a backup of all the blocks, and he would be able to see who they were transferred to.
Yeah, that's the thing. So even if he did have a backup of his wallet, the issue was not that so much that the wallet itself was stolen, but that the money was sent out of the wallet.
Right. Right.
And so once that happens, then you're shit out of luck, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing, if he was, like, super well-known, I mean, some people I saw, like, oh, hey, if we found out which blocks these were, we could all blacklist whoever has these right now as being the thief, you know, because, again, Bitcoin is not anonymous. You could see who transferred these coins to who, and most likely they didn't do 25,000 transfers. They probably did, you know, some huge chunks.
One big one.
Yeah, so you'd be able to see who actually the current owner of these, and you could blacklist them. But, you know, you could do that if everybody knew that this was an outright theft and and it was just plain as day, and the evidence was there, and everyone agreed upon it, and everyone could just agree to block out these coins. But the thing is that, you know, you don't know what happened with this guy. Maybe he was selling a kilo of coke, and he sold it, and then he's trying to screw somebody over, you know, or, I mean, I don't know, or some other type of a deal where something's wrong and everyone doesn't know the facts and he's trying to screw someone over, or someone screwed him over and he's trying to, like, you know, not get, you know, I don't know. You know, you really don't know in these situations, so you can't come to some type of a consensus. So another topic, another point of this I want to bring up is that Gawker makes a big deal about this guy getting 500 grand stolen, okay? But the U.S. federal government and governments all around the world, they're in the business of seizing this same amount of money on a regular basis daily, okay? I mean, how many people get their homes? I mean, $500,000 home isn't much in the U.S. It's easy to find. And people are getting their homes taken, and I don't mean from – I mean, from issues with taxes, issues because of asset forfeiture. The government went in and took millions of dollars from gold holdings. And then you look at on Wall Street, the number of people who have all their money in these banks and other investment things. And then the bankers will do some type of a deal and walk away. And people, like, see the market crash and all this, and they're not demonizing that system. Well, they kind of do, but you can't look at a theft in this case and say, oh, well, this system is so horrible, because if that guy would have cashed out that money, I'll tell you right now, if that guy would have cashed out those 500,000 of Bitcoin, and he would have taken that money, walked down to the bank, and stuck it in the bank, okay?
The bank would take it.
He would have, exactly, because he'd have.
They'd be like, where did you get this?
Yes, exactly.
Because in the EU, if you deposit more than 4,000 euro, you have to tell them where you got it from. And the bank will notify the government, they'll notify the tax people saying that this person has just deposited this amount of money.
Yeah.
And then the tax people come along and be saying, hello, can we have an appointment, please?
Yeah, and then you're going to have to come up with proof of how you earned this, and this guy's going to sit here and have to say, oh, I did not earn this by selling drugs on Silk Road. I earned this by mining. Here's my GPU cards. Oh, really? Prove it. So, it's the benefit, what do they call it? You're guilty until proven innocent. And this is the way it is with all the asset forfeiture laws. If they find you with a large amount of cash or all these other things, you have to prove it's called proving the source of income. And I don't think he could do that through the mining. I don't think he could have proven it. So anyway, there's lots of.
So they concluded that it wasn't a meat-space attack anyway. So somebody had broken into his computer. I'll just send you one of the links. I've sent you a couple of links so far, and you can put these on for people to kind of have a look at. So the first one is the link to the Symantec warning about a Bitcoin virus for stealing wallets. The second one is the link to the claim that, you know, $500,000 of Bitcoin was stolen. And the third one is the link to the proof. The transactions are proof. At least the links showing that there were transactions of this amount made.
Right.
So, and here's the link to Block Explorer showing the actual transaction itself. You can see there was 25,000 bitcoins. And,
And it went to it was transferred to a brand new Bitcoin ID, not to anything that had been known known inside the blockchain from any previous transactions.
I think so.
Yeah. Something else. Oh, and one other thing I'd like to know on the market. Do you have any inkling as to what happened with the big sell-off on Bitcoins? Was this somebody that came in last week when it was at 30 and then it popped down to what they got as low as 15 or so? within 24 hours? Or?
I have no idea why that happened. It's a free market. It's as free as you're going to get for a market. And people can buy and sell what they want, and the reasons they buy and sell are up to themselves. When it hit over 30, you know, somebody thought either this is a great time for me to cash out or something along those lines, and they did so. And enough people started doing that that it brought it down. And then when it hit the low of around 15, people were like, this is a good time to buy.
Yeah,
and they bought and brought it up.
Well,
so I stopped wondering a long time ago what causes the price of Bitcoin to go up and down in such huge swings. And I've also stopped trading, trying to make money on it, because I'd go gray worrying about this.
Yes.
I'm not the kind of person who has the stomach to manage something like this.
Right. This is what I've seen in some of the discussions, is that some people making these comments about, well, you know, the Bitcoin market and everything is very unstable. When I told them, no, it's not unstable. There's new vendors are coming online every day. The Bitcoin economy, they said, is unstable. And they were basing that statement based upon price fluctuations. And I said, no, that's price of
buying. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, that's not the same thing. The economy itself
That's when you're cashing in and out of the economy. When you're dealing with people in terms of business, you know, you usually agree a price on, you know, you say, okay, do this bit of work for me. And they say, okay, I'll charge this much for that bit of work. And then you say, okay, and then you pay. And whatever happens to the price in between then doesn't really matter. You might feel more or less out of pocket at the end of your business dealings, but, you know, it's still the previous agreed price that you had with the person that you did business with. This happened to me when I got the guy to do some work for me on the web-based client. You know, I agreed a particular price, and then the price shot through the roof, and I thought, wow, he's getting a great deal on that. But it's still the same price in Bitcoin that I agreed to. And then the price is after dropping and going back up and so on. So if you're dealing with people and you just stay with Bitcoin and you stay with the prices you agree with, then, well, you don't have really much to worry about. And then there's also, if you're really worried about this kind of thing, there's a website called bitoptions.org where you can buy options for Bitcoin. Call and put options, so you can get guarantees of prices in the future now for Bitcoin,
at least for
Bitcoin and US dollar.
Right. So you can kind of hedge a little bit your.
Yeah, right.
Well, one thing that I find interesting about especially people who have not traveled outside of their countries. They don't have that much experience with dealing with lots of currency fluctuations and dealing international business. And so they see the price fluctuations happening on both sides. But the thing is that if you can do averaging, there's a guy who wrote an article on that where you can price your stuff on the price of over the past 7 days. But also, if you're moving something in and out of a system, it doesn't matter what the changes are. The changes only hit you when you're holding. So if you're selling, at the moment that you sell, it transfers over, and then you buy or sell. All your income is with dollars, and then the exchange rate changes rapidly. It's more about if you actually hold on to the currency and then exchange it back out. So, this is for another topic to talk about, some strategies for dealing with that. But it's no different than people who have been gold bugs and the like, especially over the past few years when gold has been going, you know, skyrocketing and going up and down, is you price your services in gold grams, and then you have the same problem. And then you'll have people say, well, gold is unstable. But actually, it may not be that gold is unstable. It may be that the dollar is unstable. And so it's sort of the way that you look at it. But people tend to look at the price that being unstable being the one that they're having to trade in or out of that is the opposite, or the one that they're not paying their rent in. What they don't pay, they see their groceries and their rent as stable, as opposed to you know.
Because that's the currency that they're dealing with. As long as you're just dealing with one currency and you don't, if you never had to exchange out of Bitcoin, you know, if you could pay for your electricity and your groceries with Bitcoin, then you would probably see very little, fast changes in the prices of things. Because people tend, they'll tend to average prices out. So generally, as a general rule, over the last couple of months, you'd see prices and things for priced in Bitcoin go down, but you won't see price being, five Bitcoin one day and then one Bitcoin the next day and then two Bitcoin the next day. That's not really how things work. Mm-hmm. It would just be a general slope down with the price generally coming down. And I've seen this with services that I've been buying. So with the VPN and with I've been paying for a lot of virtual VPSs with Bitcoin, and what I've seen is the price that I'm paying is steadily coming down. It's not a big drop, and a lot of the up and down swings I'm not seeing when I'm buying these things because I'm dealing entirely with Bitcoin. It's just a steady, gradual slope down.
Okay.
So it's I've not because I haven't been having to kind of exchange into or out of dollar, I've not had to deal with any of these fluctuations. I've just seen a steady increase in the value of my Bitcoins, and that's it.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. Another thing, too, is the I see these people talking about Black Friday, with the Bitcoin thing, is that most of the problems that people have had in the regular markets has to do with over-leveraging themselves, not necessarily that their stock dropped. So when the market drops really low, they have all these calls, and they have to come up with them out of their other assets or go bankrupt or jump out of a window. So, when the price goes down in Bitcoin,
the effect is magnified in that way, yeah.
Yeah. So in this case, though, when the price shot down to $15, it's like housing prices are falling. Oh, my God, it's a horrible thing. Not for buyers. not for the people who haven't been able to get into the market. When Bitcoin drops down to $15, that's a absolute fantastic buying opportunity for people to jump in. And
that's exactly what happened. As soon as it hit $15, it shot back up again because people thought, buy, this is the time to get it.
Then it
kind of leveled out at 20. So anybody who did get it at 15, they're already ahead $5 per Bitcoin.
Yeah, right. Now, I don't really worry too much about what caused it and the like, but I find it interesting to know that some of these games can go on. If you're a big holder of Bitcoin, okay, what you can and you have a market out there of people with butterflies. That's what I wondered. Was there a sell-off that happened that drove that as they were selling, some guy said a couple of people said, let's go ahead and cash out. And as they're selling, the price is going lower and lower and lower as they're taking the next offer, or did they go ahead and sell off a huge chunk, and then at the same time as the people saw that price going down, they started panicking, to sell out while it's high, and then the market panic just drove it down. Now that could have been planned too, because the guys at the top could have started the market panic, sell off high, wait until everyone else with their butterflies freak out and sell them, drive the price down low, and then immediately use that same cash to purchase at the low price, and then bring it back up.
Yeah, people can do that.
Yeah,
people can do that. I mean, that's the thing. It's as free a market as you're going to get.
Yeah.
And about a week ago, I had a person who's listed on GLBSE, and what they had done, they had previously been selling their shares at 0.75 Bitcoin per share. And they held a vote with the shareholders and said, we are going to raise the price to 1 Bitcoin per share. And all the shareholders were like, yeah, this is great. And then so that person started issuing shares and selling them at 1 Bitcoin. Well, what happened was people started, who'd already bought some of those shares, started selling them at 0.99. And then he'd lower the price a bit more. And then they'd sell them a bit less. All the way until it brought it all the way back down until it hit like 0.75 Bitcoin per share again.
Yeah.
And then he was like, then the person was like, oh, I'm not going to sell anymore on the market. what I'll do is, if you want to buy any more, buy from me at one Bitcoin in private, and then I'll transfer it to you, which is fine. They can do that. But I explained to him that that's not how it works. No one, you know, this is a free market.
Yeah.
You can't beat the free market. You certainly can't gain the market anyway.
Right.
So he acquiesced to that, and I explained to him that the only way to get your share price to go up is to start paying out dividends. And he was like, okay. And as soon as he paid out a dividend, the price went up.
Oh, there you go. Right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I've got...
That's a great
story. There's like 3 or 4 shares now on GLBSE that are paying out dividends.
Yeah, that's great. This is super. Are they publishing on this pages that you're putting up for the different shares? Are they going to be releasing on their dividend schedule?
They'll be, I don't know if they'll be putting up their dividend schedule, but I'm going to start having a record to record every dividend payment that's been made, so you can see all the dividends in the past.
Great.
And they'll have their own page, and they can put information in there.
Talking
about what dividends they plan to pay and so on.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That'll do a lot, having that up there, because people can go in there and see, you know, who has a history of paying out, and you know, what kind of numbers. That's super.
Mm. Also, interesting thing, there's been a lot of interest in Bitcoin in China now. It's starting to take off here.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What's going on over there? What have you seen?
Well, firstly, the Bitcoin Wiki, the Chinese language version of the Bitcoin Wiki, is the quality of it has shot through the roof, and most of the articles have been translated, and it's all very, very, very nice. Since the value of Bitcoin has shot up, you know, originally I had been given 100 Bitcoin by other users to manage and pay for this project to make sure that the English version of the Bitcoin Wiki was translated to Chinese, and at the time 100 Bitcoin was worth less than $100.
Uh-huh.
And I'd found someone to do that for me, and the point was to get them, you know, involved in Bitcoin, and they'd gotten like 70 Bitcoin for doing a lot of that translating, the initial work. And then months later, you know, the price has shot up, and that person got back to me and he's like, oh, I've lost my Bitcoin. He had 70 Bitcoin, and then he found a backup of it, and this guy was so happy. Just like a student. And he's so happy he found his Bitcoin backup. And in the meantime, someone had gotten on to me saying, I'm after translating this many pages. And I went back and had a look at the wiki because I'd left it for a while. And most of the important pages have been translated. Quality is very good. Looks very nice. So the Chinese language wiki is done. And then a new website, all Chinese language, is after being launched, called Bitecoin. Instead of Bitcoin.org, it's Bitecoin.org, B-I-T-E, coin.org. And it does point to the Bitcoin website, but it's kind of like a community website in Chinese language for Bitcoin, people who are using Bitcoin.
Really?
Then, yeah.
Now, who's behind this? Where is it hosted? And why the...
It's hosted outside China, I'll tell you that much. It's hosted outside China. And there's lots of Chinese language tweets about Bitcoin now.
Wow.
And if you go to Taobao, which is kind of like the Bitcoin eBay... Sorry, the Chinese version of eBay.
What's it called?
I know, Taobao. T-A-O-B-A-O.
Uh-huh.
Taobao.com. And put in Bitcoin in there, and you'll see people are selling like fractions of Bitcoins on Taobao for Chinese yuan.
Wow.
Yeah. And
man,
this is going to
take off, man. I mean, this is, you're talking
well,
about.
Well, it's starting.
Yeah, but.
So as well, my own students who I had doing projects, you know, basically I'd give them projects saying, okay, you have to do business with Western people, foreigners, and make Bitcoin, because at the time only Western people had Bitcoin.
Okay.
And so far they have earned about 45, between all my students put together, they've earned about 45 Bitcoin.
Wow.
And that's great. You know, that's theirs to keep, and some of them don't care. Other ones, they really want, you know, they're they wanted that Bitcoin and they're going to use it now.
Yeah,
they're going to be able to pay people in the States to help them help correct their English language essays and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Bitcoin, this, I don't think that most people realize the United States, it's Bitcoin is somewhat U.S. centric right now in its use and publicity and all of that. But when this takes off overseas, I think that you may see within the next couple of years, the U.S. market and usage of Bitcoins being just a fraction of what's actually going on in the worldwide market.
Probably a big fraction, but still a fraction.
Yeah. I mean, but nothing that it's like this U.S. thing. Yeah, you know, I mean, because you're talking, I mean, think about India, okay? And
well, one of my people listed on my exchange, the first person to pay out a dividend, he's Indian. He's a miner, and he's mining in India, you know? So, you know, he's based in India, so he was one of the first, wasn't the first person to list on the exchange. I think he was the second, but he was the first person to pay out a dividend.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, the rest of the world already has a lot of experience, and a huge portions of the markets throughout the rest of the world are already, you know, black market type things, and the money transfer systems with Hawala and other stuff. I just see that what we're talking about here is the number of people in India and China are just reflecting what people actually know about the system and understand it. So we're not talking about they know it, but they're not interested and not into it yet. It's just beginning to.
Well, the thing is, people. Someone contacted me, another student I had. I told them about Bitcoin in December, and they weren't interested in it at all at the time. And then out of the blue, they contacted me yesterday or the day before, and they're like, can we meet up and talk? I'm after looking at the price of Bitcoin, and it's gone through the roof.
Yeah, right. Well, and then...
So if they see money in this, they're going to be interested. Simple as that.
Yeah, and then also one of the best things that can happen for publicity is that the Indian government needs to come out with their, you know, their Indian version of Schumer, and the same in China. China already has a big history of cracking down on virtual currencies, even
greater
than the US.
China will be a bit different. So China has, over here, they have complete control of all the media, including I'll say they have almost complete control of the internet as well. Because when some, you know, no bit of news gets out unless it cannot possibly be contained. If it's bad news, and if it's good news, then they want everybody to know about it.
Uh-huh.
And so they're not going to. It's not going to be like, you know, like in the States where someone's going to come down and say we need to crack down on this. It'll just that will happen in private, and then all of a sudden the Bitcoin website won't be available anymore, and you won't be able to connect to any Bitcoin peers anymore. That's kind of how it works. However, I don't think this is going to be a problem, because there will be so much money available to people who can get around this in China that there's a big economic incentive for this to grow. Basically, simple as that. And just even from mining, the cost of electricity in China is very, very low compared to, I'd say, the EU. I'm not sure about the States, but it's fairly low.
Oh, wow.
So I think a lot of miners are going to spring up here, and it's going to be already in, to an extent, with the smart crowd that's in China, all the smart people are going to be already using Bitcoin before the government notices it and cracks down on it.
Right.
And then what will happen is then these people will already have finances and a vested interest in using Bitcoin, and they'll find ways around it, and then other people will see the money they're making, and then they'll find ways around it. So Bitcoin is actually going to become an incentive for people to get around a lot of the barriers, the technological barriers that have been put up to prevent people
right.
speaking freely.
I mean, right now they're fighting to get over the Great Firewall of China based upon, you know, wanting to read a particular website or send an email to someone about something. Now you're talking about, you know, cash.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's pretty fascinating. Now, a couple of years ago, I read some articles about the virtual currency in China. I think one of the most popular ones at the time was something like it's called QQ something. You know what I'm talking
about? QQ coin. QB.
Yeah. Okay. Now,
B is like the Chinese for money.
It's what?
B is the Chinese for money. So renminbi is like literal translation means people's money.
Oh, okay. Well,
so this is called QQB, QQ money.
Oh, okay. Now, what I saw in this article was something that I had not seen in pretty much any other country, was that the laws on regulating this virtual currency and the government cracking down on it was greater in China than I had read anywhere. Like in the U.S., it's virtually not non-existent, maybe yeah. Some exchanger laws. But over there, they were really getting nervous about what was going on with this QQ stuff, because people were using this virtual money, because I guess they can earn it by playing these games on their cell phones, and they can send it back and forth to each other. And they yep. were cracking down on it because people were using it as an exchange medium.
At first, people were using it, you know, just to buy. The whole point of QQB is to be able to buy gifts and kind of extras for your QQ account. And, you know, so you can buy gifts for friends for their QQ account, and because everybody here uses QQ, and it's a Chinese, it's like Google Chat or MSN. You know, everybody here has a QQ account.
Okay, right.
And it's a Chinese company. So, and then somebody started realizing, well, hey, everybody likes to get QQ money. They like to get QQB, and everybody accepts it because everybody, well, all the young people accept it because all the young people have accounts. So some people started accepting it for goods and then services as well, and started selling goods and services on Taobao and these trade websites for QQ coin. And then, of course, someone went along to the government and said, hey, look what these people are doing. And then the government went to the company, because all the IT companies here, they're under government thumb. And they just told the company, hey, you got to stop this. And the company basically started preventing anybody who's trading in QQ coin from, you know, they either lose the coin from their account, or they made a mechanism to make it more difficult to trade. And that was with, you know, a virtual currency that can be inflated infinitely.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the kind of trade that would happen with a currency that's limited in value?
Okay. Question. QQB, are people still using it as a cash thing right now?
Not really.
Okay. So that
some people do, but it's not as not anything like it was. Not anything like it was before the shutdown.
Okay. Now, when the people were using this, how many years ago, and approximately how many people were doing this?
I have no idea on the numbers, and it was around 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, what this shows though too is that I mean, this new generation of people, they get this, you know, 2.0 type stuff where basically this QQB was working on cell phones. It was almost like you sending money back and forth with SMS messages, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's like more advanced than what people have been doing in the U.S. I mean, the most advanced thing for that happening right now is PayPal. I mean, off the top of my head.
Well, the thing is, it all happened by accident. Nobody intended for this to happen. The whole point, so mobile phones over here, even some of the crappier ones, can have QQ installed on it. And a lot of people who don't have access to a computer will have access to the internet through their mobile phone, and they'll chat with all their friends using their mobile phone and QQ. And when they found out that you could send QQ coins using your mobile phone from one person to another, because they're only numbers stored on a server.
Yeah.
People started doing that, and it became one of the more convenient ways to pay people.
I think, you know, these things are just signs of what's going to happen. I mean, at an exponential level of adoption happening as people start to understand, oh, you mean I can just like type this and this guy's going to accept it and I can actually, you know, pay for a meal here or send this to my buddy because I owed him $5 from last night and this, just this whole concept. Once people start understanding it, as you see with Bitcoin adoption, people are starting to understand.
We have another kind of unofficial money here as well.
Well, tell us about that.
So do you know what Mooncake is?
Yeah, I read about that last week. It was insane. So go ahead and give an intro for the listeners.
So in October, around October, it changes due to year. We have Mid Moon Festival, which is like the second largest holiday in China. It's a time people get together and to be with family. And one of the things people do is they give gifts to each other of mooncakes. Mooncakes are made from like these little cakes, very pretty looking, made from bean paste. And over the years, mooncakes have gotten more elaborate, and the packaging for them has gotten more elaborate, and they've gotten very, very expensive. Now, it's become illegal here to give gifts of cash to people in government, you know, because it's bribery. Uh-huh. Some people still do, but the risk is higher if you get caught.
Yeah.
However, it's not illegal to give gift certificates for, I think for mooncakes. So what people started doing is they started giving high value, you know, 5,000 yuan, 10,000 yuan gift certificates for mooncakes. And then these officials who have these, they're like, oh, I don't want to buy mooncakes. Maybe I can give this to a friend, pay him for something. And if he accepts it, then he might try and spend it with another person. And so it turned into a kind of unofficial form of money that all needed to be spent before Mid Moon Festival came along. Because when Mid Moon Festival comes along, you have to trade these coupons, these certificates for mooncakes, or they become invalid. They expire, and then they're no use. So there'd be a lot of, you know, the trading with them would start to turn into a frenzy right up until Mid Moon Festival, and then people would trade them in, and the last person left with them would be left with a load of mooncakes that they give as gifts to someone else, or maybe eat them themselves.
Right.
So you can use almost anything as a currency.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's what's crazy about a lot of the currency and money laws. Is that they try to define money, and then they box themselves in, and then these new forms of currency, you know, pop up, and how do you deal with them? And we talked about this on another show of if you have a system where, let's say, you had a Bitcoin ledger system, and you went and you gave someone a piece of paper that says, I owe you 5 bitcoins and here's my signature. And that person could go into a central repository and use that piece of paper to sort of like a check, you know? And then you start getting into, wait a second, is this a legal check or is this an IOU or is it a promise? And then if you have people exchanging promises, is basically the only way you can stop that is by the government saying that you are not allowed to promise, you are not allowed to promise somebody something, or if someone promised you something, you're not allowed to promise that to someone else. I mean, you start getting into this whole thing of it's just, you know, regulating speech.
It starts regulating everything, yeah. But it also depends on what country you're in. In America, that kind of thing is more difficult for the government to prevent and ban and whatever without coming up against some of its own laws. In other countries like India or China or somewhere else, the government can just go in and shut people down.
Yeah, just make a decree. Oh, the mooncake sales are illegal today. Wait, what are they using for currency tomorrow?
maybe not that, but they might say, oh, you can no longer give certificates as gifts to government officials and that kind of thing.
Right, okay. Yeah. It's something else. Yeah, that's fascinating. Anything else you want to cover? We're gonna just talk for a few minutes, but we've already filled up an hour and 15 minutes, which has been a fantastic show.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much everything off the top of my head. If you want to look on your Jabber page there, I've put in a couple of links there. So
okay,
Block Explorer and whatnot that you can put up on your page.
Okay, I'll throw them all up on the show notes. And this show, these shows will be going up. They might be going up over the weekend. If not, they'll be going up at the first of the week. So
sure.
Okay, Nefario, thank you very much for following up the first show with this other great information. It's been a lot of fun, and I know listeners are going to get a real kick out of this episode also. And hope to talk to you sometime in the next few weeks with an update on your other projects.
No problem. I'd look forward to it.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow, folks. That was great. I hope you all enjoyed that. And we're going to close out here with the Crystal Method Sign Language featuring LMFAO. We'll be right back.
Sun. My waves make the bass. Let it taste all to a higher place. Four bucks for a gallon of white. I'm a highway, baby. Don't need to rush. Five days, flush the bass. Let this shit into outer space. You're a Pac-Man bitch on an old Atari. You can't just model with a hot Ferrari.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.